We'll wait just a sec. Looks like got a phone call coming in, and then we'll have a quorum that we can approve the minutes. Yeah, let's go ahead and give a regional update while we wait, and then we'll go back and approve the agenda in minutes.
All right. Yes, maybe dim the lights or something. Apologize when the auditorium's so dark. We're trying to figure out how to turn on the lights, but we couldn't figure out how to turn on the middle row of lights. So, middle section, don't fall asleep. We've had a very busy fall, a very good fall. Congratulations, Trish, on the elk. Great-looking elk. Oh, there we go. Is that better? Okay, great. So a quick update on some personnel changes in our region. We have a new aquatic invasive species coordinator, biologist Nate Owens. He came to us late this summer, replaces a guy named Mike who left us to go take a similar position in Minnesota. So we're glad to have Nate on. You all know Justin Shannon. He was our wildlife manager in this region for the last several years. He had a promotion. He is now our big game coordinator, our statewide big game coordinator. So he'll be presenting later on today. But we're excited to see what he can do at a statewide level. And replacing him, at least for a year, Justin's kind of on his career mobility is what we call it. So he's going to try out that position for a year. And so replacing Justin for a year is Guy Wallace. And many of you probably know Guy. He's worked in this region for 31 years. So we're excited to have Guy in this new role as a leader of the wildlife section. We have a lot to learn from him, so we're excited to have him on. Devin Christensen was our conservation officer in Carbon County. He moved up to Weber County, so that position is currently vacant. That's always a bummer to lose somebody. But he stayed within our state, just went to a different region. We do have a new Emory County officer, James Thomas. He just came out of post, and so he's a brand new conservation officer. He's living in Castle Dale, I believe. So we're excited to have him and have that area filled. It looks like also that we're probably going to be able to fill the Bullfrog District, which will be good for the resources at Lake Powell and for the Henry Mountains. It's hard to find officers who want to live in Bullfrog. It's kind of isolated. People with families oftentimes don't want to live there, but we found a guy who wants to go to Bullfrog, so we're hoping to fill that position very soon. And then TJ was our officer in Moab for 7 or 8 years, I believe. He went to the Grand County Sheriff's Office for a while, and now he's back for the Division of Wildlife. So we're glad to have an officer in Moab and have that area covered as well. The aquatic section wrapped up their surveys a few weeks ago. They did gill netting in the various reservoirs in our region. They found some really cool things. You can see some of the fish that they caught in the gill nets up here. Schofield, big tiger, plus several big cutthroats. At Electric Lake, they got a 10-inch kokanee, which was exciting because they had planted, I think, 4-inch kokanees back in May. And by September, they had grown 6 inches and appeared to be doing well, so that was exciting. And then at Joe's Valley, we got several large splakes, and the tiger muskies, we got several tiger muskies that are approaching the 40 inches. As a side note, at the Logan Fisheries Experiment Station, there's some mud snails that were found, which is not a good thing, but the good news is that they were found in areas outside the broodstock, and so that broodstock is protected. They're going to do whatever they can to clean up the mud snails that are adjacent to that area, and that broodstock should be protected. And then the Egan hatchery, we're just finishing up some decontamination of the cold water of a cold water bacterial disease that was found there. Conservation outreach has also been busy. We have several events that have happened and that will happen this fall. We had a youth pheasant hunt at Desert Lake. 20 kids signed up. You have to sign up ahead of time to participate because there's a big demand for that, and so they filled up really quickly. And every youth that was out there was successful, was able to take a pheasant home. This weekend at Nash Wash, we have our mule deer watch. We're capping that at 25 people, and it's through reservations through Brent. And I believe that's full as well. There's a strong interest in seeing big bucks at Nash Wash, so that's exciting. And then on December 7th, we have our annual bighorn sheep watch. It'll be here in Green River. It's been in Moab in the past, but the last few years we've done it in Green River. We have a much higher, you know, we know where the sheep are, and we'll see a lot more sheep, and so that'll be nice. And then in the middle of this month, we have a Green River shooting sports park event, a turkey shoot, so a trap shoot. The winner wins the turkey, I guess. So that'll be fun. Green River Shooting Park is kind of in construction. They're wrapping that facility up. It was initially going to be a grand opening, but I don't think they're quite at that point yet. But it's they've made some improvements, and it's looking really good. Fall is the busy time of the year for the habitat section, where they're implementing habitat restoration projects all over the region and every county. They're doing everything from restoring aspen communities in high elevation on private lands and on public lands, to building dams for the Gunnison sage grouse and Monticello, and creating wet meadow habitat for their brood rearing areas. Also a lot of big game winter range work, removing pinyon and juniper by various methods, whether it be a bull hog that mechanically mulches the pinyon and juniper trees, or using chainsaw crews to cut down pinyon and juniper trees that are encroaching onto sagebrush benches. So a lot of aerial seeding going on a lot of these projects in areas we want to increase the understory. We're planting a variety of grasses and forbs and shrubs and all kinds of things that both livestock and wildlife like to eat. So doing a lot of great things, a lot of partners in this type of project, BLM, Forest Service, private landowners, even energy companies, all teaming together to get this work done. Busy time of year for law enforcement too. Of course, as these hunts go on, we always have cases to investigate and to follow leads on. In our region, there's been more than 23 cases since September 1st. These usually split between elk and deer. It's this year's kind of on par with the other years. They're busy, but you know, just as they've been busy for the past years. And so they also spend a lot of time working different trespass complaints. And then after the hunts are over, they'll spend the winter months patrolling the winter ranges and doing work out there. The far right, the bottom right hand corner, that happened just last week. There was some fishermen that were cleaning out their fish at Lake Powell when a park ranger saw that they caught 90 fish over the limit, and they were seized and charges are pending, I guess. So
just 90.
Just 90, yeah. Wildlife section, we have CWD stations both in LaSalle and Wellington. The big exciting thing for us this fall is pheasants. Our director's office kind of did something that hasn't been done in the past. We usually release pheasants, but not to this magnitude. From a statewide level, we bought 12,000 pheasants, and we're releasing them before the weekend, so Thursday or Friday, at various locations throughout the entire state. In our region, we have them at our Desert Lake Waterfowl Management Area and our Huntington Wildlife Management Area, and then at various walk-in access areas, both in Green River and over by Hanksville. And so the pheasant opportunities are very, very, you know, it's incredible, the pheasant opportunities we have this fall. And people are really excited about it. You pull up to one of our WMAs, and there's, you know, 12, 15 vehicles parked there, which is unheard of at some of these small WMAs. And hunters are really excited about the opportunity to hunt pheasants. And so we have a website too. On our website, we show where those pheasant release areas are, and so you can go on there and figure out where you can hunt pheasants for the rest of the month. We're releasing them. We had the initial release the night before pheasant season started, and then we're doing it every single week for throughout the entire season or throughout the entire month. So they're busy doing that. Bighorn sheep classifications will begin this month and go into December, and then bighorn sheep flights will happen this month and next month as well. And that's all I got. I'll take any questions if there are any.
What was the trend on the check stations, deer harvest?
We heard that from Brad and Wade, correct me if I'm wrong, Guy. From what I understand, the hunts are a little bit up from last year, which is pretty surprising considering it was a full moon and warm weather, and you know the conditions we had weren't optimal for mule deer hunting, but the check stations reported a little bit of increase over last year and the previous year. So,
Chris, one question too on CWD. Have you run into many deer with chronic wasting disease with the check stations?
I haven't seen very many. I haven't seen what the results for this year are. Justin, do you know? Okay, so just one on the mantai is the only we know of.
Okay.
It'll take several more weeks before we'll
know. All right, thank you. All right, thank you, Chris, for that regional update. So let's go ahead and approve the agenda. Any discussion on that or entertain a motion?
I'll move that we approve the agenda.
Okay. Motion by Blair Eastman to approve the agenda.
I'd second that motion.
Okay. Got a second by Chris Meekles. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed unanimous. So we've got two sets of minutes to approve. We'll go ahead and approve the minutes from the last meeting, which would have been from the aquatics section. Do we have any discussion on that or would entertain a motion?
I move that we accept those minutes from the last meeting.
Okay. Motion made by Carl Ivory. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay. Seconded by Blair Eastman. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Most of us? Okay. And then also at our last meeting, we did not pass the minutes from our August meeting. I'll open that up to any discussion.
Well, this is Wayne, and I made the motion to postpone, and I reviewed the minutes, and I think they're well done.
So. Okay, super. Okay. So that's good. Wayne hadn't had time to read those, was able to read those. Say they look good. I'll entertain a motion on those as well.
Okay. Accept the minutes.
Okay. Wayne makes a motion that to approve the minutes.
I'll second it.
Okay.
That's the second table over there.
I got it. Brent? I'm right there with you today. I can't hear anything, so.
Is it a microphone issue or a speaker issue?
I don't know. I'm deaf too.
She's seeing a
text. Okay. A text?
I can hear you through here. I'll just turn up the.
Seconded by Blair Eastman.
Yeah, I can hear that.
Okay. All in favor? Okay. Any opposed? Motion passed unanimous. And Todd Huntington represented the region at the Wildlife Board meeting this last Thursday, and he was en route. I think he's somewhere in between here and Farron on I-70 with a truck problem. So Chris was able to get the notes from Mike King. Thank you, and we'll give a quick overview from the Wildlife Board meetings.
Yeah, so I apologize. I'm going to read some of this stuff. I wasn't prepared to do this until just a few moments ago. But the main discussion at the Wildlife Board meeting was the fishing regulations for the upcoming year. The Wildlife Board ended up approving the proposal as the division's recommendations as proposed unanimously. They also made a few motions regarding there was a lot of discussion about two possession limit versus three possession limit, or three day possession versus 2 day possession. The division's recommendation was to increase it to a 2 day possession, except for in a few waters, Strawberry being one of them. I believe there are three other waters, Flaming Gorge, not an aquatics biologist. I apologize. they ended up approving the division's recommendations that approve those 2 day possession limits. They also made a motion that that in the next survey that the division does regarding fisheries, that they include questions concerning the 3 day possession limit and the processed fish in order to obtain public input on their thoughts on the 3 day possession limit and the rule and regulations regarding processed fish. There was also let me see here. There was a presentation about the establishment of the leased chub and their refuge populations, and that was passed unanimously. And there was some conservation audit presentations, and those also passed unanimously. Anything else? Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Chris, for that update. We'll go on to number five, bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime. And just to like to remind those from the public. So after this, we will entertain any questions. And also comment, and if you have a comment, there's a comment card there when you come in, and if you will bring that up front, and we'll call your name at that time and have you come present.
Okay. Well, thank you. Tonight I'm going to give a presentation on the bucks, bulls, once-in-a-lifetime season date, hunt structures, and some rule changes for the upcoming hunt season. So to begin, we'll start with deer. For the 2014 hunt, essentially what we've done for deer and elk is we've moved all these hunts just one day forward. And so your archery hunt is going to be from August 16th to September 12th. Muzzleloader will be September 24th to October 2nd. And then your any weapon hunt will still be that third Saturday in October and go from October 18th to the 26th. For elk, we have six general season hunt dates that will be presented tonight. The archery spike will go from August 16th through September 5th, and then the archery any weapon will start the same day and end September 12th. For the any weapon hunt, it'll be October 4th through the 16th. Muzzleloader elk hunting will be October 29th through November 6th. The youth any bull, September 13th through the 21st. And that late youth any bull will be November 29th through January 15th. What I'd like to do now is present the recommendations that have statewide implications, and then after those are accomplished, we'll go through and break things down on a regional level and go region by region on hunt boundary changes and other recommendations. So this first one with statewide implications, we'd like to update Rule 657-5. This is the big game rule, and what we're trying to do here is standardize what the definition of youth is. So any person 17 years of age or younger on July 31st would qualify as a youth. This date was chosen because we don't have big game, small game, waterfowl, other hunts like that going on at this time. And in the future, what we'd like to do is we'd like to standardize the definition of youth for everything, whether it's upland game, waterfowl. They're all over the board right now. And so through this rack, we're updating the big game one, and this is something we'll come back with in the future to standardize the rules for all hunts in Utah for youth. Next recommendation is we're recommending adding an addendum to the statewide deer plan that, one, allows for mule deer transplants, and then, two, lists potential release sites for these animals. Here on the right, we've graphed which units would serve as release sites, and those are the Box Elder, the 9 Mile, San Juan Elk Ridge, Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek, West Desert West, Southwest Desert, the Oak Creek, the Pavant, and Mount Dutton. And in the packet that you guys that was handed out to the racks, there's a table on the back, and for the Southeast region, Elk Ridge was left off of that. That's an error. We've since corrected that, and it'll be presented to the board with a more complete table. But Elk Ridge will be on this release site. And the idea here is, in the future, as we go down this path of transplanting deer in Utah and having deer in hand, the intent of this is to be very transparent on where we'd like to take these animals. And some of the characteristics that these units have in common are that they're away from the Wasatch Front, where we have a lot of urban deer issues. These ranges have winter ranges that we feel could support more deer and historically held more deer, and then release sites would be away from depredation situations in most cases. So let's see, the third recommendation, this comes from an action item that the Wildlife Board gave the Southern Region in May of this year, and they wanted to determine if the Monroe unit required a different hunting strategy. And so the region, they met with the sportsmen in October, and at this meeting they held in Richfield, there were a lot of concerns expressed over the amount of spike harvest on the Monroe. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the Monroe. It's a unit in the Southern region, and what you have is an elk population that we refer to as a meta population. Essentially, you have elk going from the Boulders, the Fish Lake, the Monroe, and Mount Dutton, and they just kind of interchange in all four of those units. And if you look at the Monroe, we're killing as many spikes there as we are the Fish Lake. And so if you look solely at the Monroe, we're taking a disproportionate amount of spikes. If you look at the complex, it may not be that drastic of an issue. And so that's what was discussed. And at this meeting that was held, the group that was there really wanted to eliminate spike hunting for the entire unit. The division felt that might be too drastic, and so they talked about eliminating spike hunting for the any weapon portion and leaving it for muzzleloader and archery. And then a third option, which is always an option, is to stay status quo. The Southern Region, they reported to the Wildlife Board on this action on November 7th. No decisions were made, just presented the information. And then as we go through the RAC process this round, we are recommending to eliminate the any weapon spike elk hunting on the Monroe for the next 2 years, until the statewide elk plan is revisited. And essentially what we do in that time is evaluate how we want to manage elk on a meta population basis, look at things like restricting access so you don't have this unit that we're managing for 7.5 to 8 year old bulls on but has the most access in the state arguably. And there's some strategies like that we could look at during that time. Another recommendation that we're taking through the process is to allow archery hunting of big game on select waterfowl management areas. These would include Bicknell Bottoms, Browns Park, Clear Lake, Desert Lake, Locomotive Springs, and Redmond. The idea behind this is during August and September, you may be able to allow for some big game hunting of, say, deer or pronghorn on these properties owned and managed by the division, and they wouldn't interfere with waterfowl hunts because those don't start until October, and so it's a way to provide more opportunity. And then finally, for statewide recommendations, we recommend altering Rule 657-5 to allow for the use of crossbows, draw locks, and magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders, and this would occur for the any weapon hunts only. We also recommend altering Rule 657-12, which is a rule that addresses things like muzzleloaders and crossbows, to align with the changes in Rule 657-5. Since we have that rule open, we recommend updating definitions and other portions. Some examples of this house cleaning effort would be deleting the definition of highway. It's defined in the rule, but it's never used. We define resident, but it's already defined in code, so it's redundant, and so we did away with that. And then terms like valid application we don't even use anymore, and so we've just kind of cleaned up that rule and made it simpler and easier to understand. And then additionally, we provide definitions and minimum requirements for crossbows and draw locks. Okay, now what I'd like to do is just go region by region and talk about recommendations that were taken through the process for each one. In the southern region, we recommend modifying the Pine Valley Virgin River Bighorn Sheep boundary to be consistent with the deer, elk, and pronghorn unit boundaries. Essentially what you have here are bighorn sheep that are moving outside of the Pine Valley Virgin River boundary for sheep, and so we're just trying to make that bigger to encompass those animals. We also recommend modifying the Panguitch Lake boundary for pronghorn. And again, this is due to account for an expanding population. We have these pronghorn have moved off the unit, and they're in a place that could be hunted, so we want to provide that for the hunting public. And then finally, we recommend modifying the Mount Dutton and Ponsagant pronghorn boundary and the Parker Mountain pronghorn boundary to avoid overharvest of the Johns Valley herd. This one's interesting. Essentially what you have is Parker Mountain has the most pronghorn permits of anywhere in the state, and within that boundary there's a place called Johns Valley, and it's a small pronghorn population, and so it has the potential to have a lot of harvest simply because it's pulled in with the Parker Mountain boundary. So what we're looking to do is carve that out and then include it with the Mount Dutton and Ponsagant boundary because there's a lot fewer permits and we don't have the potential to get into that population as much. For the southeast region, we recommend splitting the 9 Mile and Range Creek Bighorn Sheep hunts into an early and a late hunt. Each hunt will be roughly 15 days in November. Justification behind this is this unit has limited access, but it also has the most permits in the state. And so you have potentially 20 Bighorn Sheep hunters driving the same road looking for the same animals. And so we wanted to break this up over time to thin that out a bit. In the northern region, we recommend modifying the season dates on the Grouse Creek Limited Entry Elk Hunt. The September 13th through the 21st is standard, but we also want to add October 4th through the 28th, and this is to allow for more harvest. There's a great deal of depredation issues there, and this is a way to allow for more harvest of bulls. They also want to include an archery and muzzleloader season to allow for more harvest. And then we recommend combining units 2, 3, and 4, which is the Cache, Ogden, and Morgan South Ridge, for pronghorn hunting to allow for more areas to hunt if pronghorns stay on private lands, which these units have the potential to do. So, for the northeast region, we recommend expanding the boundary for the Uinta Basin extended archery deer and elk hunt. And again, this is to target resident big game living in low-elevation agricultural lands. I provide a little more opportunity there. We recommend creating a new bison hunt on the Book Cliffs. And finally, we recommend splitting the Book Cliffs limited entry deer hunt into a north and a south during the any weapon portion of the hunt. And this is to address discrepancies in buck-to-doe ratios that have been prevalent on that unit for many years now. For the central region, we recommend removing bull elk from the San Pete Valley extended archery elk hunt. We recommend adding a Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep hunt on units 16A and 17A, which is essentially Mount Timpanogos, Rock Canyon, and Mount Nebo. And then we want to combine the Wasatch Mountains, Box Elder Peak, Lone Peak, and Timpanogos units into one herd for mountain goat hunting. Some dates to keep in mind and for your consideration tonight. For the big game drawing for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime, and also for dedicated hunter applications, those dates are January 30th through March 6th. If you just simply want to apply for a bonus or preference points, that date is extended through March 20th, and the results will be posted by May 30th. For lifetime license holders, they will automatically be assigned the unit they had the previous year. If these hunters want to make any changes, they need to be submitted by March 6th. And those hunters that didn't hunt in 2013 and failed to choose a unit by the deadline, they can obtain a leftover permit if they're available. Some key dates for hunters with disabilities. I won't read through all these, but essentially what we've tried to do is either 5 days prior or 5 days after the hunt that a hunter with disabilities would have been eligible for, we've just done these 5 days extension either way, and happy to answer any questions with those. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. I'll give just a real quick reminder to those of us the process. We'll first go to questions from the rack. Then we'll go to questions from the audience. And then after that, we will go to comments from the audience. Again, if you have any comments, please come up to this microphone. We have two, one for the division to answer and one for the public. If you're representing a group, it'll be 5 minutes to present. Chris will keep time, and if you're representing yourself, you'll have 3 minutes. And then after that time, we'll go back to comments from the rack. Any questions from the rack for Justin?
Justin, yeah. On the splitting the Range Creek Bighorn sheep unit, that makes that hunt, except for the Antelope Island hunt, the shortest hunt for all of. Don't you think that's a disadvantage for?
Yeah.
That's a 2 week hunt instead of a 30 day, which most of the others are minimum 30. Would it be better to extend the hunt maybe to try and spread the hunters out?
Yeah, I mean, that can be an option if the rack wants to go that way. The reason we looked at 2 weeks is most of the hunters, I can't remember, Brad, help me out on the dates exactly. I think most bighorn hunters were only hunting 7 or 8 days regardless on
they
this.
They hunted it and hunted 18.
Yeah.
So.
And there's exceptions to that, but I mean, what we were trying to avoid with it, and you're right, one of the trade-offs is a shortened hunt.
Yeah.
But what we were trying to do is prevent guys from shooting rams out from each other. And if you feel like 2 weeks isn't enough, we recommend that. I mean, what we were trying to accomplish is certainly not to restrict guys to where they feel they're too squished in there. I mean, if the rack's not comfortable with it.
For a once in a lifetime hunt,
sure.
When you compare the length of the hunt with all the other units, that's pretty short.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. It is. And what we were trying to do is just still work within that bighorn sheep time frame. And we felt like 15 days was pretty adequate for most of the sheep hunters. And I'm sure others are going to feel differently. So, yeah.
And so I had a question on that. Can you elaborate a little more? One will go the first 2 weeks and one will go the second. And how does that work? Will it alternate or how do you determine?
Yeah, so what we've tried to do is just include as many weekends as we can on that hunt. And so with this week, with this time, I think this hunt, the people that hunt the first 15 days get the 3 weekends on it. Let's see, is that right?
Yeah.
Brad, how did that work?
Next year, it's the first hunt gets 3 weekends and the second one gets
Yeah. Okay. I was doing the math in my head, and I thought 3 weekends and 15 days. But it does, because it starts on a weekend. So, yeah. So.
And then, so will that, we'll say the 9 mile always be first and the other one would be second, or will that alternate, or is there an advantage there? Or?
Yeah, there could be. That's something we're going to have to work through. I mean, if the rack feels like 3 weeks is more appropriate, we're open to that. We're not so close. The only thing that we really have is that December, these hunts generally close on November 30th, so that way we can survey that first week in December while these animals are still rutting somewhat. And so I don't know how comfortable we'd be taking it further into December, but...
Would you consider overlapping a week?
Yeah, those are options, sure. Yeah. Or not at all. I mean, if the rack feels like it was fine the way we had it, mm-hmm. that's fine too. What we were trying to do is just make it so that unit can have up to 20 hunters at a time.
Right.
And so we were just trying to separate that the best we can. And mm-hmm. so.
And there are some hunters that will go in and take their sheep right off the get-go.
Right.
And so maybe by overlapping because traditionally some of the better hunting is towards the end of the hunt, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just an eye on that too. Then, do you see any change in hunters applying for an earlier or later hunt? Any kind of point creep or anything like that, or is that going to be almost status quo? Maybe you wouldn't know.
Yeah, it's interesting because when we talk to members of FNAS and some of the sportsmen that are into bighorn sheep hunting, they felt like it may have some advantage because it's a separate hunt. It splits it out and it forces guys to use their points. But how that's all going to shake out, I don't know. We only have a set amount of permits, and so. To speculate on who's going to put in for what, that's hard to do. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple different schools of thoughts on it. And one is you force guys to choose, and it might open up a little bit of drawing odds on the one than the other. I don't know if that's going to be the case or not, though. But
one question for you on the dedicated hunter drawing. Mm-hmm. Is that held by the big game application service that does everything, or is that done by the division?
No, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially we have one contract out of Nevada for all of our applications, okay. And whether it's big game or whatever, I think they do all the same. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Because that was the one question I had, is if we keep hearing that by the time people find out on their dedicated hunters, it's hard to get those hours done, and I think that's addressed in the dedicated hunter. I just was wondering if that couldn't be done, like, during the bear application or something done earlier during that drawing to be able to provide for that, give people more time to be able to get their dedicated hunter hours on the ground.
You know what? I have not given that any consideration, so I don't know if I can speak to that. Brian, if you want to give that a shot.
I don't want to give away too much of what I'm going to say later or everybody will leave. So, no, it's a really good question. It's been on everybody's mind since they were joined together. And right now, the way that Dedicated Hunter and Big Game is tied together, they mesh. The way the drawing functions, it has to figure out the Dedicated Hunter stuff before it can go into the general hunting permits that go through the drawing. So they're really interwoven right now. Would it be cool to have it separated someday like it used to? Yeah, but it would require a whole new structure on how we do permit through the drawing.
Any other questions?
What's the difference on the buck-doe ratios between north and south bucklers?
Off the top of my head, I think on the south we're about 37. Is that right, Brad?
I didn't know.
Buck-to-doe ratios on the north versus south. I know the north were 27. What are we on the south?
37 versus 37.
Okay. And most years were 10 buck to doe difference or greater. So, okay.
And Landowner Association permits on the buck cliffs, would they have to choose north or south, or do they get to hunt either or?
As you know, we put a committee together when we made this recommendation, and we invited the Landowner Association from the north and the south, along with a lot of sportsmen that were interested in how we hunt the buck cliffs. And I remember at the meeting, the comment, we asked them about this very thing, I remember the comment they made back was, we'll make it work. And I think they were going to alter their bylaws to make it work, but I can't remember where that landed. Brad, do you have any insight on that?
I thought they were going to, Yeah,
sorry, Darius, I can't remember exactly where that landed.
So. I hope I remember right.
Their current bylaws talk about a third of the permits going to the south, the landowners in the south. So they were going to try to keep that relationship there. So whatever their tags, a third of those total landowner association tags would go to the south during that rifle hunt.
Okay, so a third of the tags would be on the south book cliffs, and
right.
Two-thirds would go to the north book
cliffs. Correct, yeah. Which is slightly higher than we'll probably end up doing on the public land or, in the proclamation. The proportion will probably be slightly different than that. But it's just based on the landowners are involved, the proportion of land that's in the south versus the north, and historically deer, total deer numbers, there's about two-thirds of the herds on the north and versus the south.
Okay. Then last question I had was on the statewide mule deer transplant list, you show southeast region showed 9 Mile Range Creek and Elk Ridge, but on the release areas, Elk Ridge isn't on there.
Yeah, sorry, and you're right, Darius, and in my presentation, I apologize for that, because in the handout that the RACs were given, on the map, it has Elk Ridge depicted, and then on the handout, on the table on the back, it was an error. We left Elk Ridge off. That's since been updated, and it's been updated for the Wildlife Board, and we're gonna present that to them at the board. So Elk Ridge is on the table as a release site.
Is there a specific area on Elk Ridge you're gonna be releasing, or just you feel like you want to?
Some of the areas were like Cedar Mesa, Lower Lost Park, Deer Flat, some of that stuff.
South Elk.
Yeah. Some of those areas where we have winter range that just don't have a lot of deer in them, but historically did, and so we thought that would be a good release site. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Any others? Okay. Questions from the audience? Please come up to this other microphone here. Okay. Seeing none, we'll go comments. And again, I just have one, so if anyone has any comments, please bring a card up.
Can we get some cards back here so we've got one?
Yeah, can I have someone pass, grab those and pass? I think they're right out there. So, Stan Baker.
Stan Baker from Moab, representing Mule Deer Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Regional Advisory Council on the subject of amending UDWR's statewide management plan for mule deer. Trapping and translocation of big game has been used by wildlife managers to achieve many objectives, including restoring wildlife populations to historical ranges, augmenting populations at low densities, and reducing overpopulation. Examples of successful trap and translocation programs include the restoration of elk, pronghorn, bighorn sheep, and wild turkeys across North America during the 20th century. Restoration of mule deer through translocation has been used to bring populations back to historical ranges in Texas and Mexico. MDF believes that one of the keys to reversing the decline of mule deer in Utah and throughout their historic range is for state wildlife agencies to finally find the missing component, which will result in the ability to successfully transplant mule deer. MDF applauds the current trap and transplant study currently underway in southern Utah. MDF believes that the current study has answered several important questions that will aid in ensuring that future transplants will be more successful. MDF has contributed several million dollars through the Conservation Tag Program, improving mule deer habitats statewide. We believe that these habitat projects have had a major impact on one of the factors involved in declining mule deer populations, the loss of habitat. No other western state has been as aggressive as the state of Utah in restoring habitat. We ask that the RACs recommend the DWR add to the amendment that predator control occur prior to any transplant operation, primarily on coyotes and cougars. If this is not the appropriate place, then we would recommend it be added to each individual transplant proposal. Managers should develop a trap and translocation management plan that includes a monitoring component to determine the effectiveness of the program. The more information that is available to managers, the more successful will be the transplants. MDF supports the amendment and stands ready to provide volunteers to aid DWR in the trapping and transport to the release sites. Thank you.
Kevin, could I ask Stan a question?
Yeah, I have one too. Yeah, please do.
Stan, on your predator management request, do you want something more severe than the predator management program that we have currently for particular herd units that are under predator management, or is that sufficient predator management?
Well, I think what we're asking for, Darris, is specific predator control in those areas that are being identified for these transplants.
Okay, so you want to target the exact release site, a certain radius around whatever release site they picked up. Okay, thanks.
Can I ask Stan a question or just make a comment? Would you want to add bear into that, or are you specifically targeting coyotes and lions?
Well, at this time, I think we're targeting coyotes and cougars. I think there's probably some opportunity to add bear on some of the units, and we'd leave that up to DWR's objectives on that.
Kevin, when they don't come to the mic, we can't pick up the response.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, so just a reminder, when we have a comment, please come to the mic. All the minutes are recorded, and that'll help make sure that we ensure that Brent's able to get all of the comments. One more question I had for Mule Deer Foundation is, I know that in the translocation that is currently ongoing, there's been a very big expense in following the deer, and I just was wondering if Mule Deer Foundation, if they will be providing any dollars to the division for that, for the collaring on the translocation. And
I'll come to the mic this time.
I would have to assume so. I think we're very supportive of all the efforts involved in that, and we have the dollars to provide that. So. I would assume so.
Okay, thanks, Sam. Okay. Troy Justison, SFW.
Troy Justison, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. We just like to say we support the division's recommendations here, and just speaking a little bit on the transplant. We'd support MDS recommendation as kind of a scorched earth policy on the predators. One thing we found out in this transplant that we've done on the Parowan front and moving them up to the Pavant is they went in prior to releasing those deer, and they did fly it and they did kill some coyotes and whatnot. But we feel that it has to be more intensive. As you go through and look at that study, out of the several over 100 deer transplanted, we only lost two or three to transplant myopathy, which beforehand we were always told that they died during transplant, and that proved that wrong. The majority of the deer that we've lost have been to coyotes, cougars, whatever, and so to make these more successful, it'll be extremely important to go in once these areas are identified to go in and clean the predators out and give these deer an opportunity to get adjusted, and I think we'll be more successful. But we applaud the division's work towards this. Thank you.
Okay, that's all the comment cards I have. Is there anyone else that has any comments from the public? Okay, seeing open to discussion to the RAC.
Well, I've got a question, I guess, or a comment. How successful is it to take a deer from the Wasatch Front that's been eating on the golf course somewhere and then putting him out on the middle of Cedar Mesa? I mean, how do they adapt to that pretty quickly? Or, I mean, can Justin answer that question? I guess it's more a question.
The short answer is we don't know. and the reason we don't know, I can get into the biology with if you'd like. Essentially what you have is deer that are living on this high nutritional plane, that are living off of rose hips and ornamental plants and things like that, and you take them out to a winter range full of sagebrush. That's going to be a transition for them, and I don't know how well they would do with that. The bacteria in their stomachs are going to have to adjust, and that's not an easy process for these animals. But do we have data on that in Utah? No, we don't. I can't cite studies of deer that we moved in 1995 or something like that, and here was the success rates, and here were the limiting factors. We haven't done that, and so I recognize that transplanting deer is opening a new door and some new opportunities, and as we do this, we're going to try to learn from it as much as we can. There's some problems with what you're suggesting. I don't have data to say one way or the other what the survival rates would be.
Who would do the predator control? Would it be you guys, or would it be, who would it be?
Well, our predator program right now, I mean, for coyotes, we've really opened that up to the public with bounties and even some contracts and different things like that. We have a really good working relationship with Wildlife Services.
Right.
We can target drainages and areas like that if needs be. That's always an option. But as far as a biologist going out, no, probably not.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Right.
So, and I just had one comment to your question, Charlie, is I think one of the successes in the translocation that was done earlier was that they found two units that in my mind are probably that are several hundred miles away that are very similar in that the Parowan Front, those deer go down our fence off I-15, but they move in the summer back up onto the mountain range, and where they're translocated down on the near Holden, very similar habitat where they winter right near I-15, they're fenced off, and they move back up on the summer of the mountain that's real close. And I think that as the division moves forward, that if there's a lot of thought into those similarities, I think that the success rates will go up. And like Justin say, you know, a deer that's on the golf course may not do so well on the Arizona Strip. But
I had one more thing. And the list that we had, we have a lot of release sites in a lot of different areas for that exact reason. Is if we're gonna transplant deer, we want to give it the best chance of success that it has, and so that's why we didn't pick one or two release sites, because we wanted some on the West Desert, we wanted some in Southeast Utah, some on the Wasatch Range, you know, just to give it variety. So that way we can match, if we're taking deer off, say, Antelope Island, what unit is a good fit to release these things. And so that's what we're going to try to mesh. And so these release sites, we won't take deer to all of them, but it'll try to be the best fit we can. So,
thank you.
Justin, are the captured deer that you're transplanting, are they primarily females, or is it just whatever you catch in a drop net kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's going to depend the situation. Like if we're trying to remove deer off of Antelope Island, we'll certainly target the females, the most reproductive portion of that population. But if, yeah, it's interesting. I think we're going through a social change right now, where lethally removing deer isn't always an option like it might have been 15 years ago. And so I think if we get into town settings and urban settings, I think we take what we can take, whether they're males or females. But if it's trying to reduce populations on a winter range, we'll probably focus more on females.
The Parowan front transplant, was it primarily females?
Yeah.
I have a question. So do you have any studies that indicate that predator control influences the success of transplant?
You know, we're the short answer is we don't have a lot of data on transplant success in Utah at all. We've done some of it throughout the history of our agency. It's not well documented. And so in Utah, no. I would have to say we don't have good data on that. As was mentioned earlier on the Parowan front, we did some targeted removal of coyotes. And we have the survival rates of those deer thus far, but that's one study at one time and place. I think as we do this, we're going to get better and learn some more. But no, I don't have those results. I don't have results. If I can speak a little more to that, one thing we do know is the deer that we did move up to the Parowan front, or from the Parowan front up to the Pavant, a good majority of those were killed by predators. And so we have some of that cause-specific mortality, but that's about it.
Was that mortality greater than with the regular deer?
Yeah. So what we did in that, the approach we took is we radio-collared the transplanted deer, and then we radio-collared a bunch of resident deer that were there. And the survival rates on the resident deer were much higher, and then the cause of mortality on a lot of the translocated deer was predator-related. So,
and I'll just make one comment as before discussion ends, so that we have kind of a motion on the table from Mule Deer Foundation that we have a active predator management before the translocation on those deer, and they also ask that the division continue to collar those translocated deer. So just if someone's thinking of a motion, maybe think of those if you'd like to address that.
Before we get to a motion, I'd like to have a more of a philosophical discussion on the splitting of the book cliffs. What's the buck doe ratio difference between the North Manti and the South Manti?
Not very
much. That probably don't vary 2 bucks per 100 does.
So it's
pretty close. The west side tends to be a bit lower, if that's any. If that's what you're getting at, like,
so if you divide east and west instead of north south.
Yeah, well, there's three different biologists doing three different districts. So we had, I think last year, if I recall, I was 18, and the southern part of the southeast part of the Manti was 16. That sound right? And the west side was 13 or 14. Is that right? Okay.
I guess kind of what I'm getting at or asking is, how much is the book cliffs needing to be divided is because it's a regional boundary instead of a herd unit boundary.
I think it's more just directed at the access a lot better. You know, deer are very accessible on the north side. I just think it is disproportionate harvest that goes north. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I just want to make sure that if we do this split, is next year, is somebody going to come in and say, boy, the South Elk Ridge doesn't have near the bucks as North Elk Ridge, so let's divide this unit one more time into two separate subunits, and so we can distribute the hunters.
That's fair. Yeah.
And now that we're kind of limited entry, essentially statewide on deer, you know, where's it going to ever end if we open that door?
That's a fair
and
question.
I was in on that committee that talked about this, and I guess I wasn't quick enough to comprehend what was going on to have this discussion at that meeting. But I'm just a little concerned that if we knee-jerk react because there's more bucks on one side of the road than the other side of the road, and it seems to me that if we give hunters a chance, and I think we're starting to see it already. From 2 years ago, I hunted the Buck Cliffs. To this year, I hunted the Buck Cliffs. There's a lot more hunters on the South Buck Cliffs this year than there was 2 years ago. And I think the hunters are realizing, you know, if hunting's better, there's more bucks on the South Buck Cliffs, so more hunters come over. And are we doing this big manipulation of splitting units for no reason? I mean, a couple more years, are we going to be saying we got more bucks on the North Buck Cliffs because all the hunters are on the South Buck Cliffs now because word's out that there's more bucks on the South Buck Cliffs?
It certainly could be the case. Can't forecast the future. Yeah, there's a simpler way. You could just adjust the overall tags on the Buck Cliffs one way or another. But there just has consistently been that dichotomy. And you know the terrain. It's just due to the fact that most of those, on a lot of years, those deer are in mid-migration and inaccessible because there's no roads there. So it probably tends to hide a few more bucks than the North Buck Cliffs does. But, yeah.
I guess my question to the division is, do you guys have any concern that if we split the Buck Cliffs, that next year we're going to be splitting Mount Hillers off of Mount Ellen because there aren't as many bucks over there and all the hunters are...
It does open a can of worms, yeah. We were directed by the Wildlife Board to look at this, and that's what we did, and that's what the committee came up with. But it does open a can of worms that way.
Okay. Thanks, Brad.
Can we talk about season dates a little bit?
Sure.
Are you okay with that? And I'm going to maybe just make some comments, and I kind of stay in the realm of elk, but you guys can. I guess I did a little bit of research on just why we are not somewhat aligned to other Western states as far as our season dates go. I'm just concerned with our archery season getting pushed farther and farther back into August. I think we start losing opportunity. And I also just think it's a concern in the fact that you really are maybe going to lose more animals. It's a concern when it's that hot, being able to get an animal out in good condition is difficult. And you also just, yeah, you're just not into the rut at all. I mean, they're barely starting to rut at the end of that season. You look at other Western states, the archery season is predominantly in September, and it's followed by muzzleloader, and then any weapon. And why we go from archery to any weapon to muzzleloader, I wasn't around when that decision was made, so maybe somebody can explain that to me. But just looking at, for example, Nevada and Arizona, yeah, archery is predominantly in September. Muzzleloader is maybe at the end of September, the beginning of October, and then you have any weapon. You know, and just looking at what's more difficult, you really need to give the advantage to the weapon that's the most difficult to obtain an animal. And that means putting the rut or archery within the rut. So I'm just making some general comments, and it'd be great if you guys could give me some background as to why any weapons before muzzleloader. Or, anyways.
Kevin may be able to do a better job than I do here, but I know in when we rewrote the statewide elk plan, which I think was 3 years ago, I think we're making recommendations for our fourth year, there was a lot of conversation about hunting around the rut, and it was interesting because I don't like to think of hunters as archers or muzzleloaders or rifle, but if you categorized them that way, everybody wanted their piece of the pie, and there were discussions about in Utah it's so difficult to draw a permit that if you do it with the rifle, let's put that there. And with that committee, it was very eclectic. It was statewide. All the interests were present, and that's just where it landed with the give and take that goes on those types of committees. This isn't new. I mean, this came up last night about should we even be hunting in the rut? And so a lot of good discussion with it, but I think those decisions are best made with the statewide elk plan, which will really be coming up in 2 years. I know that doesn't answer all your questions, but that's it landed where it did because of the public process and the public involvement. So, do you have anything to add to that?
One thing I'll add, and then you can add if you need to. But just a little history. Before we went to the 29 deer units, actually the division went out with a survey to look at. It really opened up all the hunt dates, not just elk but mule deer, and we. And the division went through a really big effort and was really coming close to actually changing some of the archery dates, combining the deer with the spike hunt, and a whole bunch of big effort. But it all come together right when the 29 units and Director Karpowitz was worried that to have all of these really big decisions converge at one time.
Okay.
And so those decisions were tabled. But there was a lot of effort done and a lot of thought into kind of maybe moving a little bit towards what some of the western states were doing, and a lot of thought was there. And so I don't know if that will, in the mule deer or the elk plans, if that will ever surface again. But I know that there was a lot of discussion and talk on surveys on maybe doing that. I don't know.
It's something that... I don't know if we have a set date on when we're going to revisit it, but it comes up quite often. And I know in that public process, we even held open houses and things like that, and come tell us what you think of these dates and taking it through the racks. And from my recollection, it was all over the board.
Okay.
You'd have one person stand up and say, we need archery in the rut, and the next person stand up and say, no way. And so we never really tied that up with a bow. It was just informational at that point, and a lot of interest.
Okay.
So. One thing, can you talk, Justin, about how that works? So it moved up one day, but talk about the calendar and how that.
Yeah. So essentially, what we're trying to do is, I've always thought of Utah hunting as you have your rifle hunt that third weekend in October for the any weapon, mm-hmm. and that kind of dictates everything else on it. And so you're gonna have variation 4 or 5 days either way on certain hunts. And so I think some of these archery hunts have been August 14th to the 18th, you know, right in there, starting and ending. That's guesswork, but it doesn't vary much from that weekly set. And even what Kevin was talking about, we even discussed firm dates on, you know, should it always start August 15th or whatever, you know. There was a lot of good discussion, but it never really settled anywhere. So.
Any other discussion? Okay. We're ready for a motion.
Darris, do you want to keep that? What do you want to say about your booklet?
I guess I'm okay with splitting it as long as the Landowner Association keeps their word that they'll split their permit somehow too. I don't think it's fair that if the Landowner Association has permits and they can hunt either or both sides. Then I don't think that's fair. But if we're kind of at their mercy because they just get a wad of vouchers and say here, distribute these. So I guess time will tell. We'll see how they distribute them and we'll go from there. But I really think it would take care of itself. But being I was part of the committee and agreed to what's in this recommendation here, I'll still support splitting the north south.
One thing that I would just like to mention before a motion's made is being a wildlife biologist, I like to read a lot of studies and follow the biological side, and so this mule deer translocation has been something that I've been very interested in and followed real closely, and Troy Justison talked about it a little bit, but the deer myopathy that has always been thought to be a really big issue actually was very little mortality in this translocation, but most of it did come from predators, and so I think that the proposal by the Mule Deer Foundation holds a lot of validity, and so I think that if the division is going to put the dollars into moving the deer, I think that needs to be a real big focus to give the best, at least, you know, up front, to give the best effort that we can to help those deer survive. Just a thought.
I have a comment on that, because I generally am opposed to predator management. And there has been a study done in Utah by Dr. Beshta, a recently retired professor of biology, on mule deer in Zion National Park. And what they found that with the absence of cougar, the deer actually destroyed habitat. And so the deer were there, but they were not doing well. But where there were cougar, the habitat was good, and the deer were doing fine too. The deer populations were probably not so badly impacted by the predators. So, you know, part of that problem is just that you've got new animals in a new place, and that's the same problem you find with bear. You know, you kill off bears, new bears move in, they become, you know, problem bears. So, if you're really looking at habitat, it's a way of managing animals that really has to be prime, and so manipulating predators is just not in the long run a suitable way to do that.
When stating what I did, I agree. I think that to have healthy mule deer populations, you've got to have the habitat, and it's not all predators. But what I was wanting to state is that you're exactly right. In these deer being translocated, they're trying to get their bearings. They don't know where security cover is. They don't know where those travel corridors are, and so, you know, they're trying to learn what those resident deer already know. And so any help that we can give them for a short period until they learn those movements and those characteristics of that habitat, I think this will be a short-term thing to help them get established on the ground.
How big a radius when they put those deer on the pavon? Did they stay fairly localized? They spread out like popcorn in a popcorn machine, or what'd they do?
You had both. You had some that took off and are difficult to find and still are, and then you had some that stuck around. And you kind of hear about those outliers, and so I'm not exactly sure what the core population did on those movements. I can certainly dig that data up and talk to the principal investigator at BYU. But I know they experienced both. Some stayed put and some took off. So.
If we're talking realistic predator control on a deer transplant, in your estimation, are we looking at a 3 or 4 square mile? Are we looking at a 150 square mile? How big an area do we need to nuke predators to be effective?
I don't know.
One comment, that is when they moved those deer in the winter, there was a couple outliers that moved, but the population really stayed really close in the winter near those resident deer. When they seen the movement is in the spring and summer, when they started to make those movements back, then they started to see a lot bigger. But I think that to answer Darius's question, you know, for 4 or 5 months, I would say, look, following that study, it was actually very close where those deer were, you know, once where they get their bearings and that kind of thing, I would say. But
Yeah, I guess to answer it, I don't have the answer on exactly what it would look like, but if we were to do predator control on something like this, we'd probably want to map those data and look at the data points and see how far from the release site they went and timing a year. I don't have that in front of me, but if we do this, it's something we can certainly look at.
Do they still have a poison collar? I know they experimented with them with domestic sheep at one time for a coyote to eat a sheep once and then it'd be dead after it chews on that collar. So is that still an option, or is that?
Yeah, you know, I know those were really big in the 70s and 80s and things like that, but I haven't heard of much use on them in mule deer. I can look into it, but I haven't heard much use. I know we haven't done it. I don't know if we've ever done it. Guy, have we ever? Yeah, I don't know if we've ever done it.
Okay. I'll make a motion that we accept the division's recommendation, bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime, with the addition of additional predator control on release areas of mule deer. And I guess leave it up to the division what they feel is the most accurate place to incise this predator control.
Okay, so we have a motion by Darris to accept the division's recommendation for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime, with the addition to have a active predator management.
Yeah, I mean, all these areas, if we're moving deer into them, they've already got predator management on them, so I mean, it has to be above and beyond our predator management, so it has to be something in addition.
An additional pre-treatment before translocation.
Yeah, correct.
Is that sufficient, Brent? All right, got a motion on the table.
Second.
Seconded by Charlie Tracy. All in favor? Okay. Opposed? All right, one opposed, Wayne Hoskinson. Agenda item number 6.
Thank you. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the division, and tonight I will be presenting the 2014 Buck and Bull CWMU and also the Landowner Association recommendations. To begin with, we have, when we go through the CWMU application process, we basically receive three kinds every year, and I'll go through those real briefly because it affects what the recommendations are. The first one would be new applications. New applications are just that. They're brand new. They've never been a CWMU before, but they could also be CWMUs that have changed their land ownership more than 34% or the acreage on the CWMU more than 34%, and that kicks them into a new category where they have to reapply if they do that. Renewal applications, the CWMUs are on a three-year renewal cycle, and so every 3 years, if they wish to stay in the CWMU program, they have to reapply. And change applications, these are amendments to the current certificate of registration and their management plans that they submit. And the things that we deal with on these are the change in permit numbers, the change in the permit allocation or the private and public ratio, and the change in season dates. And those are the three things that require action from the regional advisory councils and the board. So for 2014, we received four new applications for CWMUs. Two were due to land ownership changes greater than 34%. Two are brand new applications. We had 13 CWMUs this year that required renewal for 2014 to the 2016 years. And eight CWMUs submitted change applications that, like I said, that either they changed their permit numbers, their season dates, or their public-private split ratio. And if approved, if all were approved, it would bring the total of CWMUs for 2014 to 119. And just as an overview, statewide, like I said, we're proposing there have been applied for 119 CWMUs. The northern region has 72 of those. Northeastern has 5, central 12, southeastern 17, and the southern region has 13 CWMUs. And with this, there's over 2.16 million acres enrolled in the CWMU program, of which 96% of that is private land. And there's about 446 private landowners that participate in the CWMU program. So the recommendations for the 2014 CWMU buck and bull permits are, I won't go through each one of these, but they're broken down into buck deer, private and public permits, management buck deer, bull elk, buck pronghorn, bull moose, and both the private and public. So a total of we'd have 2,938 private permits and 469 public permits. And we had some changes that have come in since the presentation was given, and I will talk about those changes, and this number will change by one. But basically, the 14% of all the allocated public permits or allocated permits are going to the public. Okay, I'll go through the recommendations by region. Northern region had three new applications. Grouse Creek is an elk. It's because of a land ownership change. It's in the new category, but it's a previous CWMU. Hartscrabble is the same thing. It changed ownership, and there's basically no change in the management plan or the application. And the TL Bar Ranch is a brand new, and it's a pronghorn CWMU in Box Elder County. We recommend approval of all of those. There's nine renewal applications in the northern region. There's Blue Creek, Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Jacobs Creek, Lazy H Ranch, Mountain Top, Neal Creek, Stimlin Creek Ranch, TJ Cattle Company, and Woodruff Creek South. They had a few minor changes to their old applications, but the division recommends approval of all those. We had some in the northern region, change applications. Whites Valley is a change application. During the process, we discovered that there was a calculation error on the amount of on the compensation to the public because of the inclusion of public lands in the CWMU. The numbers had changed. What the Whites Valley has requested is that they go to a split. They're requesting 10 total instead of the 13. Then the split would be 8 private permits and 2 public permits. And the extra permit on that from a 90-10 split is the compensation for the public land in that. The Deseret had some changes. They added more private acreage. What they did is they added some private lands that are adjacent that were joining the Deseret Ranch. There were important winter range properties, and they added a few public permits to compensate these people for providing critical winter range for wildlife populations. And they also requested to change their split from on elk from 85-15 to a 90-10 split. And the Washakie, New Core West, and Ingham Peak all had either reduction or addition of a few deer permits. Ingham Peak is adding elk to their application. There was no adjustment on deer permits. They just added elk to their application, and we recommend approval of all those. Southern Region applications, Spring Canyon is a new application. The numbers are a little bit misleading on this. It was the division recommends denial of this. There's some public lands, there's 600 acres basically of public lands that is not, doesn't follow the rule as being able to be included in the CWMU, which would make it having not enough contiguous acreage to make it qualify for a CWMU. And if there's, I know there's going to be some discussion on this tonight, and so I do have a map that shows the configuration of the proposed CWMU. Red Ranches is it's a renewal, and recommend approval of that. Mini Mod Ridge, this is something that will require action on. Mini Mod, the division recommends approval of the application without the inclusion of State Section 2 that was previously taken out, I believe, at the request of the Wildlife Board. They're asking to have that added back in. If it is included in, the deer permits would change. The deer and elk permits both would change. So there's no net gain to the mini mod CWMU for private permits. But if that section is included, there would be an increase in the public portion of the permits. The Southern Region. Emma Park and Schofield Canyons the Emma Park is a renewal, and we recommend approval of that. Schofield Canyons, we recommend approval of that one. It's a change application. They're requesting a decrease in the number of deer permits. Southern Region applications, we have Black Point is a renewal application. And we recommend approval of that. Oak Ranch would be a change to what was submitted originally to in the RAC packet. They asked to withdraw their change and go to what was originally approved on their application. They were at 19 total of 16 and 3, and they requested to have the change application withdrawn. So this will change the numbers a bit. The Central Region applications, this Coyote Little Pole is just a change application. They requested to have one additional private bull elk added, and it doesn't change the splits or anything. So we recommend approval of that. So what the changes would be on the overall numbers, there's a net increase of a total of one more private permit would take it to 2,939, and one public permit would be the net increase as a result of those changes, and it would take it to 470. And that's what we'd be approving. Okay, thank you.
On the Spring Canyon CWMU, the new application, the public land that 4,900 and somewhat acres, that included 600 acres of public land.
Yeah, if the public land was included, this number has changed, and I think our final number has changed several times. Our final number that we came up with if the public land was included, and I'll show you a map of this. If the public land is included, it would come out to 5,017 acres, which would put it barely into the minimum requirement for a CWMU, a deer CWMU would be 5,000 acres. The problem we have with it is that if you're looking right in the middle of the screen, the green sitla 600 acres is the property that's needed to make it be a valid CWMU. To make up the original 5,000 acres, the minimum 5,000 acres, it has to be a contiguous property, and contiguous doesn't mean, by the definition, doesn't mean touching corner to corner. And so without that sitla section of property, it doesn't qualify. In order to have public lands qualify for inclusion into a CWMU, there's three requirements. It can have, it has to be completely surrounded by private land or otherwise inaccessible to the public. And so it's not completely surrounded, and it does have public access. It's bordered to the south by quite a bit of public land. It also, the second criteria is if it's needed to make a definable boundary, and the third criteria is if it's needed to meet the management, herd management objectives for the unit. So that's the three criteria where it can be included. So
using that definition on the mini mod ridge one, where the school section is recommended not to be included, I think that school section is completely surrounded by private, but the landowner on one side is not part of the CWMU, and he allows access by permission through his property to that section. Is that why that's excluded from the mini mod?
Yeah, I think partially, and I probably have to have the region address that, but it had been previously taken out. I think it was because of that region at the request of either the Wildlife Board or the regional or the CWMU Advisory Committee or both. And so I don't know the background on that. I'd have to have the region address that if Brad would, I think.
Yeah, Scott was right. On the upper corner, there's someone that can access that state section from their property. And also on the southern half, there's a different property owner. So there's two property owners in question. I think it was 4 years ago, we had that state section included. They came to the RAC meeting. The RAC voted to exclude it, and the board passed that as well. The CWMU is asked to include that again because they thought they had things resolved with those two landowners, but in the end they didn't have them resolved. So, you know, instead of going through the same fight again, we figured it would be in our best interest to exclude the state section.
So is this school section here on Spring Canyon at 600 acres, is it considered accessible from on the south?
Yeah.
If it was just the corner on the northeast, would that still be considered accessible on a walk over the corner kind of thing, or is that considered inaccessible?
Yeah, and to my knowledge, and we might have to talk to law enforcement about this, but as we enforced it before, corner to corner access was not considered a legal access. So the access would be coming from the south there. If we're dealing with trespass and trespass laws, technically I don't believe you can go cross on two corners that are touching like that.
Just to clarify something, just the premise of all this is, if you're familiar with Carbon County there, this is from the Consumers Road and the Gordon Creek upper fields there. They're owned by the Division of Wildlife. It's a straight shot of public land from that road all the way to there. Can a guy get there? There's no road access, clearly, and it's some very steep terrain. It's going right over the top of Bull Point and into a canyon. But just the premise of locking up public land on a part of the mountain that has not very much public land is kind of the premise why we opted to stick with this, you know, and the rule backs us up that way.
If I might add something also, the division, you know, for the CWMU program wants to be very careful about shutting off or denying public access to public properties. It's not needlessly, it's not needed, you know, and sometimes, you know, with remote properties, that makes it even more attractive to some hunters to be able to hunt that because they feel that, you know, it might harbor more animals. But we just want to be very, very careful about restricting the public access to the public lands with the program. So that's why we recommend that.
What is CITLA's stance on it?
CITLA wrote a letter was submitted with the application, said that they support it if it fits within the rule, if it fits within the legal requirements to include it in the property.
So they're okay reducing or limiting access to public lands then? Is that what we're saying there? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, they're saying it's okay if we do it, but as long as it fits within the legal parameters to include it into the CWMU.
Interesting.
So, and that letter has been sent.
So it looks like looking at the map, there is still some additional private land that's not there. That if they, it looks like it's quite broken up, but they would be able to pursue some opportunities to meet if they so desired.
Yeah, and we've discussed this with, and I think the representative is here tonight. To discuss that, but we've discussed some of the opportunities, and some of it would be to purchase CITLA lands, which a lot of times they're willing to sell. They just have to put it, you know, it takes, there's a time process it has to go through. And, you know, they've looked at other options. You know, the big problem on this is blocking up that center section because it doesn't meet the rule to touch corner to corner like that, and somehow that has to be remedied. You know, and then if there's a portion or all of the CITLA section was purchased, then that would make it a valid seat. It would make it eligible to be included in the CWMU. So.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Again, just questions. When you come up to the mic, please state your name and come to this mic over here if you have any questions.
This one?
Yeah.
Why don't I start off then? My name is Floyd Hatch, and I'm a real estate broker in Salt Lake City, and I am here representing Rick Gatherum, who owns the acreage in the blue. And I want to say that Scott is a wonderful friend. He was the biologist who helped me put together a CWMU on our Morgan County property several years ago. And Brad will be a friend as well. And so there is nothing unfriendly, nothing, you know, in my mind that's controversial here. I just want to point out where we started, and there are always two sides to every story. The reason the acreage changed is as the submittals came in, we weren't exactly sure of the acreage we had. And so each time we'd come in, it'd be checked to the recorder's office, and there were changes. The last one was asking about the BLM acreage that's in yellow. And because that is surrounded by private acreage, we are able to include that regardless of where we go. It was our contention, and Rick Gatherer more than myself, that what's going on below that CITLA acreage, yes, it's public ground, but it's a long ways to a trail or a road, and I still feel that legal entrance into that CITLA acreage would be very difficult to do. The roads are a couple miles to the south. All the trails go through Gatherum property. One can get there, but it'd be pretty difficult to do that. Every one of us that have packed deer and elk out of places know that a couple miles on horses up over the top of a mountain and down are a lot different than just doing something on a flat trail. So we accept everything that's been said. We understand we've got some work to do. From what I understand, on that corner-to-corner kiss on the Gatherum property, you could take 1 acre of CITLA and comply with where we need to be and then go get the 599 acres some other place. But we have talked with CITLA. Discussion are ongoing on how that could be put on the auction either in May or September. Black Hawk Coal Company has not been an easy group to get a hold of, but you know, we're working very hard with that. And then you can see we've got another CWU directly on the west. The interesting things to me when I started were this was a CWU at one time, and most of you down here will know that probably better than I, called the Ghost Town Getaway. But it wasn't 5,000 acres. It was the gathering acreage, and then the stuff called Foy was gathered together, and it was 4,000 and something acres. And as the CWU program improved and gathering bought the property with the DWR's help, that's when the CWU went away, and he was told, you've got to have 5,000 to make it happen. So this is a work in progress, and it needs to happen. And I just want to make sure that when we come back next year, we really look forward to tonight, because we knew this was the region where the property sits versus the other racks. And just want to be able to point all these things out and answer any questions. And I appreciate the stuff that's come up. I understand public ground as well as anybody. And we don't want to be doing something that's not right. But it took, you know, getting on the schedule and being able to come tonight to really understand where we were. So we'll do, and we'll stay in communication with Brad, and we'll get this done, you know, one way or the other. I did think it was interesting that Sitla said let's get it done, but we need to be within the DWR confines. So I think they'd be willing to. I haven't gotten the final word, but I think they'll be willing to sell all or part of that 600 acres.
But have you petitioned for it yet?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, just been the last couple of weeks since the RAC started, but I've gone to the Salt Lake City office, to the man that's over this region here. Sorry, I can't think of his name right here, but he said, I will take that in front of my bosses. We'll talk this over and we'll come back. They do have an auction scheduled in May. Something, some other place is going to go on auction, and so that will happen here. I also want to tell you, Mr. Gatherum has the grazing lease across this already. So that puts him in the game no matter what, because he's already involved with the property. He'll be able to be involved in the final auction.
But it hasn't been petitioned for yet.
In the process, it has not.
In the process. So yeah. Kim or Rick will work with you on that. Kim Christie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Salt Lake office? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other comments from the audience?
That's it. That's all.
Okay. Comments from the RAC?
Scott, can I ask you another question? Back, I want to go back to the mini mod CWMU for a second.
Okay.
Reading back through it, we visited this at least one time, I remember, and one of the families came to us and asked us about it. We had a pretty lengthy discussion. So do we need to make another kind of a decision on this board concerning that state section, or has that been done, Brad, in their application, and they're ready to move on? What's going on with that, I guess?
Well, what is right now is the division recommends the approval of the application with, without the state sections, which would mean 36 private deer permits, 4 public deer permits, and 36 private elk permits, and 4 public elk permits without the state section included. If the RAC or the board decides to allow the inclusion of that, then the numbers would change to the bottom one. So it's just whether we recommend approval without. It just depends on what the RAC and the board decide whether to include that or not. The numbers would change. So, and that's what you'd be voting on.
Scott, can you? Yes. You may have spoke to it. Can you speak again to the state section and the access to that public land?
That I'll have to refer to Brad, because he's a lot more intimately familiar with that than I am. So, if we could.
Sorry, I don't have a map. In the northeast corner of the state section, it's a corner-to-corner access from an adjacent private landowner. And then in the southern, there's a full 80 acres that, you know, where it joins another private landowner who's not, both these owners aren't in the CWMU.
And that's where the problem arose before, wasn't it?
It was actually the northeast corner last time. The I won't name names, but
right.
two different property owners there. And I think he's on the brink of making a deal with them, but without that deal made, we didn't feel like we should go forward with it.
And the other two landowners aren't interested in belonging to that CWMU, are
No,
they?
Haven't had interest that way. Interest that way. That'd be the easy solution.
But not happening.
Not in the near future, yeah.
So right now we're looking at, if we include the state section, the public gets an elk tag and two deer tags.
Additional public tags.
If we don't include it, there could be several public have access to that state section and be able to hunt it.
Yep. I don't know if I'm shooting them in the foot with this. They've kind of used that state section to take some youth hunters up and, you know, during that youth any bull hunt and things like that, both the CWMU, because they have access to it, and those adjacent landowners. So, you know, there's some opportunities there. But, you know, it's completely controlled by those two private landowners for the most part.
Just so I can visualize this area, is this the top of 9 Mile? Is this up?
Minimod Canyon comes into 9 Mile Canyon there. Yeah. It's about halfway up, and it's right south of the Minimod Road there. And it goes all the way up to the divide there where it drops into Whitmore Park, I don't know if that helps. It's a full section.
I have a question to you then, Brad, on this. Like Darris followed up with there, so it's with the section, you get one elk and two more deer, but without it, you don't have it. So access through the private land, is that controlled by the private land? It's not open to just public land access?
No, there's no county road to it or anything like that, so it's just controlled by those two landowners.
So it's the landowners that determines who goes on to the state section on that
Pretty
case.
Much, yeah.
But okay. Those other two landowners have access through their property.
Right, but the public doesn't have access through their property.
It's not about public access, really, and unfortunately.
Okay.
Just a curiosity question. They get a lot of deer tags. How old are the deer they're killing? I mean, that is rough country over there. And
yeah.
That seems like a lot of deer.
We don't collect age data on deer on most of these CWMUs. So I've looked through the harvest data and compared CWMUs in the region, and it certainly on the aggressive end of harvest. What they've had to do to make that work is there's so many landowners involved in that. They've had to, I think the guys with the that are guiding hunters are only taking a third of those tags and giving the rest back to the landowners so they still have an opportunity to hunt their own properties. That said, as far as the CWMUs in the region on the quality, and it's on the lower end, but certainly still a good limited entry sort of opportunity for the public hunters who draw that tag. We haven't got complaints yet. So,
then what about the elk, Brad?
Elk, the average age is, by far the lowest in the CWMUs in the region. Mm-hmm. And that said, it's triple the permits that most of the CWMUs, you know, as far as elk permits per acre. It's in a unit with, it's an anti-bull unit where, we're not having to, unlike a limited entry elk unit where we'd have to have it be proportional to the number of tags on the public land. That's not really the case on any bull unit. So,
what is their average age right now on the elk that they're?
It's 4.1 or something like that.
Pretty young then.
Young, yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, I got one question real quick. If you leave the state section in there, the public hunters, do they just get to hunt on the state section, or do they get to the whole CWMU area?
Now, in the CWMU rule, if you include public land in a CWMU, the way the rule's set up is we need to compensate the public for that. So they'd have access to all the CWMU, okay. Yeah. And maybe for clarification, what we're recommending to approve is basically the status quo, what it's been the last 3 years, and that's without the state section.
Without
the CWMU wanted to include it this year, and we're saying no thanks.
My name is Travis Field, and I'm one of the landowners that borders this. If you guys had any questions that you wanted to ask me, I'd be more than welcome to answer them.
What do you do when people ask permission to get to that state section through you, Travis?
I had two youth any bull hunters up there this year that accessed up through. They hunted our property plus the state property. I usually try to keep it to two hunters per hunt. So I think I had three archery hunters for deer and elk, and then two for the youth any bull, and two for the regular elk, and I think one muzzleloader deer hunter. And it's just kind of a whoever comes and asks me type thing.
Charge access?
No. Mm-mm. And that's one thing I don't feel I should have to, or I should be charging people access to go up to hunt state property. So I don't. And I could actually have got you names of everybody that actually hunted up there this year, but I didn't do that. Okay. But I could get them put together if you guys needed.
No, thanks, Travis.
Is there a motion?
Yes. Blair has something all ready to go.
No, I'm trying to keep my mouth shut. Can't you tell?
Do we need to address this then again?
No.
Or it's done?
Yeah. Well, it depends on which way you want to go. But the division is recommending not to put that section in.
Okay, good. That's what we want. I'll come get my check tomorrow.
And we've got a quiet group tonight.
Well, I'll make a motion to accept the CWMU management plan as presented.
Got a motion on the table by Wayne to accept the CWMU management rule as presented by the DWR.
I'll second it.
Okay. Seconded by Blair. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passed unanimous. Agenda item number 7. Permit number.
Okay. This is the Landowner Association, the voucher recommendations. The permits come to the Landowner Association in the form of vouchers that are redeemed for licenses. We don't need to take a break for these guys. Okay. Okay, so statewide for 2014, we received 15 applications. The DWR recommends the approval of 12 applications as we received, and three of those are split recommendations. There's a total of 15 landowner associations that were applied for. The totals would be 115 deer vouchers. Of those, there would be one management buck voucher. That would be on the Ponsagon. 76 elk vouchers and 8 pronghorn vouchers. Okay, we had several split recommendations. The Panguitch Lake Landowner Association in the green has been resolved since this presentation was put together, and they requested 8, but now they're agreeing with the division's recommendation of the qualified permits at 7 and 7. But the Vernon Landowner Association is a buck deer landowner association. They requested 35 permits. They qualified for 28. And the division recommendation is 28. What happens on the landowner associations is they qualify for a percentage of the total of the permits that are allocated for a limited entry unit. And for example, if in order to be a landowner association, they have to come up with 51% of the private lands that are in that unit. And then they take that percentage of the land and the percentage of what it represents for the unit, and that's how many permits that they qualify for. And when the limited entry unit permits decrease, and they take a correspondingly decrease for the landowner association. So the Ponsagon Landowner Association is for management buck deer. They requested 4. They qualified for one because of a drastic cut in the management buck deer permits, and the division recommends one permit on that. And the Indian Peaks Landowner Association, this is a request on a yearly basis. They have a bull elk landowner association. They request three premium permits, which would allow them to hunt all the seasons. They qualify for three permits, and we recommend three permits, but without the premium status on it, it doesn't fit. It doesn't qualify by rule to do that. One of the other changes that was put on there was that if you look at your sheet for the landowner associations, it was added in the Henry Mountains Landowner Association qualifies for one buck deer every 3 years, and 2014 would be their third year. So that was added since the RAC packet went out. And that would be the only change. So thank you. And one of the things I better qualify, we were going to present a change to the landowner permit rule, but it wasn't included in the agenda. It wasn't a clear item in the agenda, so we decided we were going to take it through on the next RAC tour in December. And so this will be presented to you during the December RAC round. So, thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience? Comments from the RAC? Motion from the RAC.
Yeah, I'll make a motion. We accept those landowner association recommendations made by the division to accept the recommendation for the permit numbers for this year, 2014.
Okay. So we got a motion on the table by Carl Ivory to accept the landowner association permit as presented by the DWR. We have a second.
I'll second that motion.
Okay.
Are you going to do it, Trevor?
No, that's fine. No,
seconded by Tricia. All in favor.
Sorry.
Do you want an update?
No, I'm good. Okay. Thanks.
So unanimous.
You just kicked PNR out of the CWM Association. Wait, did you get me out of the CWM?
I'm an amendment.
You just donated all your permits.
I'll tell the boss tomorrow.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. My name is Greg Hansen, and I'm here to present a new administrative rule and licensing program proposed by the Division of Wildlife, the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program. Last year, the Utah legislature passed some amendments to the Wildlife Code that allowed for certain situations where a child could use the permit held by a hunting mentor and to go out and take an animal on that permit. The purpose behind this new program was to increase youth recruitment into the sport, remove barriers that might have prevented youth from participating in hunting, create a structure and network to teach youth on proper hunting ethics and safety, and to try and encourage hunting in Utah as a family experience. So the division took the changes to the Wildlife Code and drafted a new administrative rule. It provides that sets up certain qualifications that both the minor children and mentoring adults have to meet in order to participate. It creates an administrative process to make sure that those who are participating in the program actually qualify under the code, and allows us to track permit usage to see how successful the program is in bringing youth into the sport, and also sets up certain requirements out in the field to ensure that mentoring is actually occurring and youth are actually learning the tools that we're wanting them to learn to become Utah sportsmen. So can my child participate? The program is limited to Utah residents in order for the on the child side of things. The child has to be a Utah resident in order to participate. They must be between the ages of 12 and 17 when hunting, and they must possess a Utah hunter's education number, so they must have gone through hunter's education. There are two different classifications of children that can participate. First is if the child is the child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward of the hunting mentor that's accompanying them in the field, or if they are suffering from a life-threatening medical condition. So the children that have a life-threatening medical condition don't have to be biologically related to the mentor that is out in the field with them. In order to qualify as a hunting mentor, you can be either a resident or a non-resident. But you must possess a valid big game permit and be 21 years or older when hunting. We've set up in code that the mentor is responsible for ensuring that those that are out in the field are complying with all elements of the Wildlife Code, administrative rules, and stipulations put forth in the Big Game Proclamation. And we've prevented any type of compensation to the mentor from being provided. So we don't want there to be a financial incentive for a mentor to take a child out in the field. And we also feel that by eliminating any type of compensation or incentive in that way, we ensure that the two types of classification of children, the program will be limited to those classifications. So you won't be taking your neighbor's child out. It will be child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward. If you feel that you qualify for the program, we ask that you submit an application to the division at least 10 days before the requested date of permit sharing. A handling fee will be assessed, which is established by the legislative fee schedule. Right now that's $10. And the hunting mentor is responsible for providing all elements to satisfy qualification for the program. So they will provide a permit number, a description of the minor's hunter education number, and a certification that both they and the minor qualify for all the elements that are laid out in rule, that they are the minor, the minor is the child, grandchild, legal ward, that they're at least 21, the mentor's at least 21 when they're out in the field, et cetera, et cetera. Further, if the child that will be participating in the program is not, if the mentor is not the legal guardian of the child that will be participating in the program, we're also asking for written authorization from the minor's parents that they are aware that this process is happening and that they give approval for the adult to take the child out in the field. You'll notice the asterisks on the permit number. Right now, the division has proposed that this program be opened up to all big game permits. So that would include once-in-a-lifetime permits, antlerless permits, limited entry permits, and that's for your guys' consideration. Further, we've limited the program to only one minor mentor pair per permit. So a mentor can only have one child in the field at one time. But if they'd like to take a different child out in the field during that same hunting season, we've set up a process where the mentor can surrender the certification that was provided for one minor, submit a new application, and share the permit with a different child. But It's one minor mentor pair at a time per permit. If you do qualify, there are provisions that are required for once you're out in the field. The mentor must be close enough to the minor to communicate with voice and hand signals. They must provide advice and assistance with proper technique, safety, and hunting ethics. And they're responsible for carrying with them in the field all elements that prove that they qualify and have been approved to participate in the program. So they must possess their hunting permit, hunting license, all of the certifications that were required, and the division approval that shows that they've gone through the approval process with the Division of Wildlife. For the license, we've waived the license requirement for the minor to participate in this program as an incentive to try and get them out in the field. Both a mentor and a minor may carry a firearm if they qualify for the program, but only one animal can be taken and tagged. And so we've stuck closely to that one animal per one permit requirement. If you do participate in the program, all the rules for variances, surrenders, refunds, and disability accommodations will be based on the type of permit and the individual using the permit. And all bonus points, preference points, and waiting periods will be assessed to the hunting mentor, not the minor. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is any questions from the RAC?
Yeah, I have. Would you expand this to like trapping and everything else, you know, bear hunting and lion hunting and all that, if this went well?
Right now, the way the code section is written, and it's limited to hunting. It says you may use the hunting permit of another. Mm-hmm. Originally, the division had considered only limiting the permit sharing to general season big game permits, and so right now we've expanded it farther than our original thought process was. These type of programs have been really successful in other states, and they see quite a bit of use. So I think it's something we'd probably look at and see how successful we are this go around. Maybe adjust our program accordingly, but. Right now, that idea hasn't come up yet, but I don't think it's anything that would be totally foreclosed at all.
You've got it. So a mentor can change. If he wants to take another child out, he can switch to a different child?
Yes, yeah.
Can the reverse happen? Can a child go out with two different mentors, like a mother and a father both have permits? Can the child go with one parent and then next weekend go out with the other parent, kind of thing?
There are other limitations in code that limit you to taking, like, you can't possess more than one antlered big game permit at a time, and you can't take more than one antlered big game permit in a single season. So I guess there could be a situation where a child goes out with one adult one weekend. That adult then surrenders their sharing that following weekend. The second adult, well, you'd still have your 10-day administrative period that would have to be a buffer in between the two sharing periods. But if there was a surrender that happened, a 10-day waiting period and a second approval, I believe that situation could occur, but there would have to be a pretty lengthy administrative process in between those two.
Now, if we're talking cow elk tags, there's an early season cow elk hunt. Mm-hmm. The child goes out with one mentor, and the other parent draws a late season cow tag. Mm-hmm. If that child is the one that shoots the, well, you can kill two cow elk. So mm-hmm. I guess it never
worked. It could happen. Yep.
Okay.
But I guess the main incentive or purpose of this program isn't to take opportunity away from existing hunters. It's to increase opportunity for youth and get them out in the field, get them hooked, and hopefully make it an enjoyable experience for them. So that's the main push behind this program.
One question I've seen on the rule with the mentor that the youth must be within hand signals or distance. I'm just wondering if there's physical restraints of the mentor to be able to get out, if there's an additional mentor that'd be able to help them, or if it's just the one that has a permit.
That's a good question. I am relatively certain that under ADA accommodations we'd be able to accommodate a situation like that. I don't know how often something like that would occur, but we do have processes in place to address disability situations like that. So many of those are so situationally specific that I don't know if I could speak in a broad context, but I'm pretty confident that we'd both be able to and probably be required to come up with an accommodation in a situation like that.
Any questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Comments from the rack? Please state your name.
Roland Tallarico. My question is, over two permits, can the same child do two different hunts with two different mentors? If I draw an archery tag, can I take my nephew on an archery hunt, and then my dad, which would be the grandpa, can he take him on a rifle hunt?
The child that participates would have to fall into one of the two categories that are laid out in rules, so either a child, grandchild.
Right, but I mean, even though you said one animal can be taken, can he still, like if he shoots a bow and kills a deer on the deer hunt, can he still go?
He can only possess one animal.
Only one.
But can he go on the rifle hunt with his grandpa and not shoot it? Can he just go?
Oh, yeah.
Because you still have the tag for the animal, but can he still...
He could still go, probably not under this program, though. He could still attend on the hunt, but...
But he wouldn't be able to do any
because
shooting
he could,
or anything like
that. Because he couldn't take the animal, there wouldn't be the incentive to have him share the permit. There would be no reason for him to be able to take that animal.
Other than the experience
of
it, so that he could decide which kind of hunting he would like to go with.
Well, and we would encourage him to attend that second hunt, just not carry a weapon.
So I guess that brings up one question I hadn't thought about is, so if a youth signed up one with the dad and one with the grandpa and he'd take one on the other hunt, how would that be taken care of with that permit that he would have?
Well, I guess it would depend on what the two types of hunts were. If it was an antlered hunt and an antlerless hunt, then you don't have those restrictions in code for possessing two permits or taking two animals of the that are both antlered. If they're both antlered hunts, the child wouldn't be able to participate in the second.
He can only have one permit.
One
at a
permit
time.
At a time.
Okay.
Yep.
I guess another question here from the rack. And it's probably following up with what you've got. If I, with this scenario where the grandson goes out with grandpa, but he shoots the deer with an archery tackle, and he's the minor being mentored, but he also has, say, a rifle tag of his own without being mentored, then that you couldn't have that.
No.
So as soon as that minor, maybe he draws a limited entry tag, he probably wouldn't enter into this mentoring.
No.
Okay, that's my clarification.
No, and that would probably be a surrender process where you surrender your first certification.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically you're just giving a kid a chance. If he doesn't draw out, he can still go this way.
Go out, yep.
Yeah. Are you ready for a motion? I make a motion that we accept it as it has been presented.
Got a motion on the table by Charlie Tracy to accept the division's mentoring, youth mentoring program as presented.
I second it.
Seconded by Chris. All in favor? Unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you.